The impact of physical distancing, face masks, and eye protection to prevent SARS-CoV-2 transmission.
How long do you give antibiotics to somebody that has a bacterial blood infection?
What's the impact of handgun ownership on suicide?
And diabetes and COVID infection.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, this is the first time in weeks, of course, that we're going to talk about a couple studies that are not related to COVID-19. But why don't we start with those first, since this is still a really important thing that's going on, and I'm afraid it's going to be with us for quite a while. Let's turn to The Lancet, taking a look in a meta-analysis at the impact of physical distancing, face masks, and eye protection to prevent person-to-person transmission of SARS-CoV-2. This is a meta-analysis, not surprisingly. There's 172 observational studies across 16 countries and 6 continents, no randomized controlled trials, and 44 comparative studies in healthcare and non-healthcare settings. In total, their N with regard to patients is just shy of 26,000. Not surprisingly, they found that protection against infection with the virus was increased as distance was lengthened, and they took a look specifically at a meter, which isn't that far, is actually less than the 6 feet that we're hearing about here domestically. They found that face mask use could result in a large reduction in risk with, again, not surprisingly, N95 or similar respirators superior to disposable surgical masks or cotton masks, but not disparaging the use of those. And also, they identified that eye protection could be associated with less infection, and it's something that has been overlooked by a lot of people. On the downside, I would say that they did find that healthcare workers and folks who have to use the masks all the time identified that there was decreased equity with regard to their interactions with patients, as well as difficulty communicating clearly in that interaction.
So, Liz, I'm going to try to put some numbers for it for our listeners so they can realize the magnitude of the benefit of these measures. If you remove yourself 3 feet from an individual, you decrease the risk of infection by 82%, whether you're in the hospital setting or in the community setting. And by the way, every additional 3 feet, you double that benefit up to being 9 feet away. For mask and N95 mask as well, it reduced the risk of infection by 85%. And again, there was benefit in the community setting and in the hospital setting. And as you mentioned, eye care, particularly for workers that are taking care of individuals. And in this particular study, they looked at MERS and SARS. There are actually no studies of eye protection in COVID patients. The use of an N95 mask and for the other coronaviruses, eyewear, reduce the risk of infection by about 80%. So it doesn't mean we don't need to do hand washing and sanitizing. That ends up being incredibly important as well.
Clearly points to the need for us to promote and continue to use masks when people are out in public. And I would just note that in today's headlines, there was a study taking a look, it's a qualitative study, taking a look at resistance to mask use and having Black men specifically say that their concern about using masks is that it results in a change in behavior when people interact with them.
That's an important point to consider. I mean, we're wearing masks to either prevent someone from passing the infection on or for getting it. We don't need to be in a situation socially where we can't encourage that, or especially where it's discouraged because either we can't communicate because we have it on, or more importantly, we're concerned for our own safety. I'm glad you brought that up.
Let's turn to diabetologia, if you will. A study taking a look at what happens with folks who have diabetes when they are infected with COVID-19.
This is the largest study to date looking at this particular group of individuals called the Coronado Study. And again, it looked at coronavirus disease in diabetics. It was conducted in 53 different centers in France over a period of about 3 weeks in March. What they discovered is in the first 7 days, almost one-third of individuals with diabetes have one of two complications, either being on a ventilator or death. And specifically, the death rate was about 11% in the first 7 days. When they look at pre-hospital risk factors, the thing that really fell out was actually obesity. It wasn't actually diabetes control or how long somebody had diabetes or what their hemoglobin A1C was. Once they got hospitalized, if they had a history of vascular vascular diabetic complications, if they had a lot of shortness of breath, or if they had increased labs, such as an AST, that's a liver enzyme, or C-reactive protein, that's an inflammatory marker, or a decrease in white cell count. So what this suggests is that we need to be particularly vigilant about making sure when individuals with diabetes are hospitalized or in the community, we do everything we can to prevent them from becoming infected with COVID virus.
Well, maybe as a vaccine comes across the transom, they should be among the group who receive it first.
They're certainly in a high-risk group and probably related to the increased inflammation that occurs in that setting.
Let's turn to something other than COVID-19 for the first time in weeks. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, a study that I thought was extremely important, taking a look at the relationship between handgun ownership and suicide in California. This is a huge study, and it's a huge study that has taken place over 12 years and 2 months. It took a look at handgun acquisitions and deaths in a cohort of 26.3 million male and female residents of California over this time period. I'm going to give you all the data because I think that the data really speaks for itself. There were 676,425 cohort members who acquired one or more handguns. Of that number, just shy of 1.5 million people died during the time period, the study period. Just shy of 18,000 died by suicide, of which 6,691 were suicides by firearm. When they took a look at the hazard ratios, the hazard ratio was 3.34 for all male gun owners as compared with male non-gun owners for committing suicide, 7.16 for female owners. So really dramatically higher for these female owners. These rates were driven by much higher rates of suicide by firearm among both males and females, the hazard ratio of 7.82 for men and 35.15 for women. Over this long period of time, they found that 52% of all suicides by firearm among these handgun owners occurred more than 1 year after acquisition, saying to me that there's a durable risk of suicide by firearm if you just buy one.
One might say, well, these are actually individuals that just have higher rates of suicide overall. As you highlighted, the risk of suicide by firearm increased dramatically, sevenfold, almost eightfold among men and 35-fold among women. When you looked at the non-gun suicides, they were no different than the general population. So it wasn't a group that had more depression or more life circumstances and therefore were more likely to commit suicide in general. This was specifically limited to suicide by firearms. It tells us we need to inform individuals that are thinking about buying a gun what the risk is, not only immediately, but just having one around the house as well. And we also need to be more vigilant to people that either have depression or life circumstances that on the spur of a moment do something that they wish they wouldn't have. Other types of suicide, for example, by ingesting toxic agents, is less lethal. And if a person does that one time because of life circumstances and they recover, they're oftentimes not likely to do that again. They've survived that event. But the same is not true with handguns.
Now, handguns are, of course, a very effective means of committing suicide if that's one's desire at that point. One of the questions that occurred to me in the midst of all of this was, I would like to see a subsequent study that would kind of do a look at characteristics of people who choose to buy handguns and see if we can't point to that or see if there's a correlation that then would indicate a subsequent risk for suicide.
So, Elizabeth, they looked at the handgun owners versus the non-handgun owners. The gun owners were a little bit younger, 41 versus 43 years of age. They were more likely to be male. 78% of the handgun owners were male versus 44% of the non-owners. They were more likely to be white, 75% versus 61%, more likely to reside outside an urban area. That is 17% lived outside an urban area versus the non-owners, which is 10%. And perhaps, as you're suggesting, these are the people that we need to target. So they realized that the dangers of owning a handgun, again, not just immediately, but there was a sustained risk of suicide over the average follow-up, which was over 6 years in these individuals.
And impressive that this study was published, I just have to note. So kudos to the authors. Let's turn to your final one that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The effect of C-reactive protein-guided antibiotic treatment duration. In our worry about antibiotic-resistant organisms, how can we be better custodians?
These are bacterial infections of the blood, and more specifically for our healthcare providers, gram-negative bacteremia. And in this particular population, most of it was due to a urinary tract infection. And not surprisingly, these are older individuals, average age of about 70. The question is, how long do you treat these individuals with antibiotics? When I trained, we said, well, 10 to 14 days. And we know that the longer someone is on an antibiotic, especially if they don't need it, the more likely they are to develop resistant organisms or to develop a superinfection like C. difficile. They studied 7 days versus 14 days, and they realized, well, 7 days was really not any different in terms of outcome as 14 days, but you could use less antibiotic. What these authors said was, let's tailor it. Let's use inflammation, that is C-reactive protein, to guide it. In this study, they took a look at almost 600 individuals and divided them into three groups, those that got 14 days of antibiotics, those that got 7 days, and those that got treated on the basis of their C-reactive protein. And once it decreased by 75%, they would stop the antibiotic. They wanted to make sure the person didn't have a recurrent infection, they didn't develop a complication, and they didn't have to go back on antibiotics, they didn't have to go back in the hospital. And what they determined was that the outcome among those three was pretty much very similar. Individuals that were treated with C-reactive protein, there's a couple caveats. One of them, 21% of them didn't complete the protocol. Either the patients refused to continue having their blood drawn, because you have to have your blood drawn every day, or they didn't wait for the C-reactive protein to go down by 75%. They were just discharged from the hospital. And on average, they were on antibiotics for an average of 7 days. What that tells me is, even if you use C-reactive protein, you're going to be on antibiotics for about a week. So my overall take is, you probably don't need to use C-reactive protein. You can just do antibiotics for a week and you get the outcome that's very similar without having to go through the trouble of measuring C-reactive protein and having blood drawn regularly.
I think this is potentially helpful in making us better stewards of antibiotics, but I think we're still sort of looking for a magic bullet there.
Yeah. So what you would hope is, by using C-reactive protein, you could even cut the antibiotic usage down even more. But they weren't able to do that. It was really no better. So I'm not sure that there's much bang for the buck from using C-reactive protein.
On that note, that is a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.